the podcast from Belmont Chapel in Exeter, sharing the story, living the life. For more information, go to belmontchapel.org.uk.
Okay, Faith and Fish. I've spoken about some funny titles at Belmont in my time, but this must be one of the weirdest. What does faith have to do with fish? Actually, my grandfather, who was a fisherman, would have said there's a great deal between faith and fish, because unless you have some kind of faith, you're not going to catch anything. But that's not really what we're talking about tonight. So how does this passage connect together? It's a bit of a strange one, isn't it? At the start of it, you've got a miracle that people very, very desperately want to happen, which just isn't happening. And Jesus makes it happen. And then just as you're thinking, wow, this is incredible, and he gives those promises about if you have faith as small as a mustard seed, you can say to this mountain, move from here to there, and it will move. Nothing will be impossible for you. Just as he said that, and you think, but this is illimitable. This man can do anything. There is nothing can stop him. Just then, he starts saying to his disciples, look, the Son of Man's going to be delivered over to be killed and then to raise to life again. And they're filled with grief. They've suddenly started to realize it's not all roses. It's not as sunny a story as they thought it was going to be. He may have all power. All things may be possible to those who have faith, but somehow there are limits on what's going to be achieved. And then you have the final story, which is a miracle nobody's actually looking for or expecting until it happens. And coins in fishes' mouths. What's all this about? How do you hold all of this together and get a subject out of it? Well, I think there are two things going on in this passage mainly. The first thing is, in that first story about the epileptic boy, you have the situation that we all get into from time to time when faith doesn't seem to work. Maybe something that God has seemed to deliver regularly just isn't being delivered anymore. Let's face it, one of the reasons that the disciples came back to Jesus and said, why couldn't we cast it out? Was because they had cast out a few demons by this point. As far back as chapter 10, Jesus was sending them out to replicate his ministry. And they had seen amazing things happen. And now suddenly they'd hit the buffers. It wasn't working anymore. Why not? And so that's what the first situation is about. What do we do when it seems that we've prayed and prayed and prayed and God just isn't answering? What do we do when it looks as if the obvious thing for God to do is to step in and produce a miracle and make the whole situation right, and he seems to miss his cue? What do you do in a situation where faith doesn't seem to work? And the second part of the chapter is a different situation. It's about when God answers faith. Peter has the faith to believe that Jesus is going to want to do the right thing. These people turn up to collect the tax and say, your master has not paid the tax yet. According to our records, he doesn't pay on an annual basis. He hasn't paid a lifetime lump sum, which is the way that some people pay the tax. He should have paid it back in the spring if he pays annually. That's months ago, so what's going on? Does he pay the tax or does he not? And people say, oh, yes, he does. Because he has faith to believe that Jesus does the right thing. And then probably starts thinking, well, yeah, well, I know he'd do the right thing, but what Jesus thinks is the right thing isn't always what I think the right thing is, so have I got it right? And Jesus comes in and sorts out the whole situation. And this miracle takes place, which would never have happened if it were not for Peter's faith. And then his faith in going and doing something ridiculous. Go catch a fish. Look inside its mouth. Master, I've caught hundreds of fish every week for the last 3 years, and you want me to look inside the mouth of one? And that's something I've never done before. Yep, there's a coin in there. Oh, yeah, there's a coin in there. And because he's got the faith to do what Jesus tells him, ridiculous as it sounds, Jesus does something absolutely amazing. So, there are those two situations, I think, where faith doesn't seem to work, and then when God answers faith, what lessons can we learn from those? Let's look at the first one to start with. What's the problem that the disciples have? Why can't they cast out the demon here? Why are they so helpless in what's going on? Well, the problem, it seems to me, isn't that they need more faith. But they need to conquer the unbelief that's inside them. You see, the picture we often have, I think, is that when you become a Christian, you've got a little bit of faith. That's the red dot inside the guy's head, okay? He's a converted, born-again evangelical, and he's got a little bit of faith there. And as you go on along the Christian pathway, you get a little bit more faith in Jesus as time goes by. Yep, he's got it now. There we are, and he's a growing Christian. He's possibly even a Christian leader. He may well be on a functional team at Belmont Chapel, and the faith has grown inside him so that he can do amazing things. But it's not that simple. In fact, it's not just a case of having a little tiny bit of faith when you start that grows and grows and grows as you get to know Jesus better. It's the fact that right from the start, inside you, two things are struggling together. It's a bit more like this. You've got the faith, but you've also got the old unbelief. Now, three words we need to keep separate are faith, unbelief, and doubt. Okay? It is not sinful to doubt. It is sinful to have unbelief. Faith is the attitude that trusts God for everything. Unbelief is the attitude that says, no, no way. Either you do it yourself or it doesn't happen. God is not a Father Christmas who's going to do anything for me. I've got to do it myself. Doubt, well, Os Guinness once described doubt in the title of a very, very good book on the subject as faith in two minds. You're pulled towards faith, you're pulled towards unbelief, you just don't know where you should be, you're somewhere in the middle. You're hanging on to your faith, but you're being attacked by unbelief. And Os Guinness says, there's nothing wrong, nothing sinful about being in that position, you just don't want to stay there too long. And so doubt is not something you need to condemn yourself about. So if all of a sudden you start thinking, what if the resurrection didn't really happen? What if the Bible can't totally be trusted? What if God didn't do a miracle when I thought he did? If you have feelings like that, those are opportunities, not problems. They're opportunities to explore further, to find out the facts, and to resolve your doubts. Unbelief, however, is the thought that says, I'm not going to believe this. Whatever you do, I'm not going to trust. I'm not going to step out in faith on anybody. And the problem here, it seems to me, is unbelief. Now, when they say, why couldn't we drive it out? Jesus comes back and says, because you have so little faith. And that certainly is what the best manuscripts say, so little faith. There's an older group of manuscripts as well that say, because you do not believe, because you have apistia. Pistia is the word for faith. Apistia is unfaith, unbelief. Now, it probably is so little faith. That's probably the best reading, so the NIV's got it right. But what does it mean by so little faith? Jesus goes on to say, you've got very little faith. If you even had as much faith as a grain of, as a mustard seed, you could say to the mountain, move from here. So you haven't even got that much. So although Jesus is saying you've got a little bit of faith, he's saying it's completely inoperative. Why? Well, because in their heads, what's happened is the unbelief has grown and it's knocked the faith into a smaller and smaller area. And so somebody who was starting to believe God is all-powerful, God will do things through me, has been knocked a bit, and the faith has diminished as the unbelief has grown. And I think there's a problem here. Not that they don't have enough faith. Because sometimes people say that. If you just have a bit more faith, then God will do amazing things. So what you've got to do is imagine yourself into the situation. Put the picture of the car you want God to give you on your fridge and pray and visualize. See yourself driving that car. Imagine what it's like to fill it up with petrol at the services. And the more you can imagine this, the more likely God is to do it. And that's not, I think, what having more faith is all about. Having more faith is dealing with that little nagging seed of unbelief that can grow inside you into a plant unless you deal with it. John Bunyan wrote several books, as well as Pilgrim's Progress, and this is one of them, Come and Welcome to Jesus Christ, an old book about what the gospel really is and what it means to have faith in Jesus, and it's still around today. There's a modern version of it. And in it, he gives 25 contrasts between faith and unbelief. Didn't do things by halves, John Bunyan. 25 contrasts. I won't give you all 25, don't worry. Let me mention just four of them, just to make the case. Bunyan says, faith sees more in a promise of God to help than in all other things to hinder. Unbelief sees more in the things that hinder than in God's promise to help. In other words, faith and unbelief look at the same situation and take different things out of it. Faith sees the clouds, faith sees the problems, faith sees the obstacles, the barriers, the difficulties, and says God can overcome all of that. Unbelief sees those things and thinks it's insuperable. God can do nothing in that kind of situation. And Bunyan says another thing is that faith gives comfort in the midst of fear. Unbelief brings fear in the midst of comfort. Faith keeps you going even when you have all kinds of worries nagging at the back of your mind, even when you can see clearly the way it could all fall apart and you could get egg on your face, you could fall flat, God might not deliver. And faith somehow keeps you going through the midst of all of those natural human worries. Unbelief is the opposite. Unbelief is what assails you out of a clear blue sky when faith is enjoying the presence of God, and it brings fear even in the presence of comfort. Third, faith makes great burdens light. Unbelief makes light burdens heavy. If you hang on to your faith in God, if you allow that to develop, if you get into the habit of trusting Him more, then what happens is that your burdens become lighter. You can bear them more easily. And I've known people of tremendous faith, and sometimes when I've looked at their lives, I've thought, how do they handle it? How can they cope under those pressures? Life has given them some crushing disappointments. Things haven't worked out the way they wanted. Everything seems to hit them at once, and yet they've kept on going and growing, and they're joyful and they're radiant. How have they managed? It's because faith can make heavy burdens light if you know how to keep it growing. But when you allow unbelief gradually to come in around the edges of your faith and push your faith into a corner, what happens is that the unbelief makes your burdens heavy. Fourth and final thing, faith lifts us up when we're down, but unbelief throws us down when we're up. Faith has a positive impact on your attitudes. It lifts you down. It allows you to have joy in the worst of circumstances, a peace that passes understanding. All of those things that Paul described in Philippians when he was in jail himself and not knowing whether he was going to live or die. That's what faith does. It encourages you. It gives you nerve in those situations. But unbelief throws us down when we're up. And we don't enjoy what we're supposed to enjoy of God. We don't look with confidence to the future. We don't look around and appreciate what God is already giving because we cannot believe it. So that raises a big question, doesn't it? If the problem is unbelief, how do we cope with it? How do we feed our unbelief so that it grows inside us and pushes the faith into a corner instead of eliminating unbelief from our lives? I think there are one or two clues you get from this passage. Let me just mention five things that I think are in there. First of all, we feed our unbelief when we give in to our own natural perversity. If you think I'm being cruel, that's exactly what Jesus says here, isn't it? You unbelieving and perverse generation. No wonder he responded like that. I mean, we just had the transfiguration as described by Adam last week. He's just been up on the top of the mountain with some of the great saints of the Old Testament. He's just experienced the presence of his Father in a way he rarely did on earth. It's been fantastic. And his disciples have been up there with him. And it's been wonderful because he's seen a kind of foretaste, a glimpse of what it's going to be like when Old Testament and New Testament Christians are brought together, and it's all arranged around the centrality of Jesus. This is what the cross and the resurrection are all going to be about. No wonder Jesus is excited. And he comes down the hill, and here are his disciples battling with their unbelief, trying to do a miracle and falling flat on their faces, miserably defeated. The Father, who's starting to have doubts that any of this will work, is saying to Jesus, if you can help, will you? That's in the Mark version, not in the Matthew version, so don't look at it down here. And Jesus says, oh, you faithless and perverse generation. That word perverse comes from the word to twist, to distort. You find it all over the New Testament in different ways. When Paul's talking to the Ephesian elders, for instance, at the his last visit to them at the book of Acts, they come down the coast to meet him, and he says, be careful, because savage wolves are going to come in amongst you, and they're not going to spare the flock. And of your own selves, he says, men will arise, distorting the truth, twisting everything. And the word he uses is the same word that's used here. So something that's perverse is something that's twisted out of shape, that's not fit for purpose, because what was real and good and proper has become ineffective through just being put out of alignment. It's all twisted. And we have a natural perversity, which Jesus recognizes here. This is what human beings are like. You show them what God can do, and instead they start doubting it. They allow unbelief to take over, and then they can't do anything. because they're faithless and they're perverse. And if we allow our own natural instinct, nah, this doesn't work, no, nobody else believes in me, no, then we feed our unbelief. But there's a second thing too. We can develop systems instead of depending on God. Now, this is an interesting one, because I think this is something that often happens too, that we get used to God acting in certain ways, and so we think he's going to act that way in future. And one thing that I found many Bible commentators theorize, speculate about here, is that maybe the disciples, having been sent out in chapter 10, had fallen into a way of conducting miracles, and they thought it was just a bit like a recipe. I quote this Old Testament verse, I command the demons in this way, and suddenly they all come out, and then you pay me the check and we all go home. Yes, wonderful. And it didn't work that way. They'd fallen into a routine, a way of doing things, and suddenly it wasn't working. Because the miracles that they were doing in the name of Jesus didn't depend on a certain way of doing it. They didn't depend on a technique that they'd picked up over the last few weeks and months. They depended on absolute dependence on the power of God. They depended on faith. And when you substitute technique for faith, you're going to hit the buffer sooner or later. And it's possible to develop systems of doing things instead of believing in God. One of the things I've been involved in very infrequently, but enough to watch what other people do it, is this whole business of dealing with the demonic, going into situations where something is troubling an individual or a house, and just rebuking it in the name of Christ and praying a prayer of faith to get it sorted out so that that individual or that place can be at rest once again. And I've studied the way that other people do it, and most people fall into a pattern. There are those people who use holy water, high church exorcists and people like that. There are those who use the Rituale Romanum, an old Latin prayer that's been used down through the centuries. There are those who, well, there are all sorts of techniques. The weirdest one I ever heard of was an American guy who became a Christian after a pretty interesting career, very colourful character indeed, not much education, and he discovered when he became a Christian he had a real gift for this kind of thing. And his technique was very simple. He'd just say, okay, demon, I'm giving you 10. Then I want you over there. 10, 9, 8, 7, 6. And by the time he reached 1, the demon had quitted. Well, that's not exactly the way that bishops in the Church of England would do it. But you see, I found that all of those techniques will work or won't work depending on one thing: how much the person concerned uses them simply as a channel for the faith to hook into the power of God. Because it's through God that it happens. And if using a special phial of water helps you remind yourself of that, that's fine. If quoting the name of Jesus and quoting New Testament texts helps you remind yourself of that, that's fine too. It doesn't matter. But the power in any situation is going to come from God and not from you. There is no technique, there is no system, there is no recipe that will do it automatically. It always depends on him. Now, third thing. It's possible to feed your unbelief by relying primarily on the evidence of your senses. We get used to living life just on the basis of what we see from day to day and making our decisions based on that. And if you are going to be a person of faith, you need to be constantly reminding yourself by soaking yourself in the promises of God in Scripture, by going back to him frequently in prayer, by trying to see life through biblical eyes, that this is not reality. This is one fraction of reality. But God is far bigger and far more powerful, and there are far more possibilities in the universe than you see with your eyes at any one moment. And so keeping in that kind of mindset is important. Interesting that when you read the same miracle reported in Luke's gospel and the disciples ask the same question, why couldn't we drive it out? You get another bit of Jesus' answer, and Jesus says you couldn't do it because this kind comes out only by prayer and fasting. What he's saying is, you people couldn't do it because spiritually you're not prepared enough. Look at me. I spend nights out on the hillside in communion with my Father. You look for me and you can't find me because I'm off praying again. I have devoted myself to living life as a human being in as close contact with my Father as I possibly can, until you reach that kind of position where your dependence upon God is absolute. You're not going to have the spiritual strength or the power to see those things happen, because you'll still be seeing through world-centered eyes rather than through the eyes of faith. So we rely primarily on the evidence of senses. Number four, we fail to remember God's promises and God's past mercies. You see, the disciples had seen a lot happen. They'd been sent out by Jesus some time before. They'd seen Jesus himself do lots of miracles, and now somehow things were happening through them as well. And they were coming back to Jesus, Lord, Lord, even the very demons are subject to us in your name. And Jesus said, you think that's a big deal? Your names are written in heaven, that's a much bigger deal. But yeah, it was great, it's fantastic. But you know, it's funny how we forget those things after a while, isn't it? And even the biggest and most amazing coincidences, answers to prayer, things that just fall into place remarkably and make us think at the time, wow, that is definitely God, a few weeks down the line can lose a little bit of their power to convince. And so we end up in the same situation again, just as distrustful, just as worried, because having experienced something in the past doesn't necessarily build our faith for the future. And it's important for us to remember how God has led us so far. That's why thanksgiving is so important, isn't it? Remembering what God has done. That's why the Bible goes, remember, 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 again and again. Not because God wants us to be grateful and nice Christians should always be thankful, but simply because it's good for us. When we remember clearly the stuff that God has done, the perils he's led us out of, the way he's taken us through all of our difficulties so far, then it becomes more easy to build our faith and to remember that the God who's not let us down so far is not going to let us down again. But so often we don't remember, and when we fail to remember God's promises, fail to remember God's past mercies, then our unbelief grows. There's one more thing to say as well, and I think this is perhaps something that was going on here too, although I've got no proof of that whatsoever. We think that big deeds require big faith. Because we've seen God answer in small ways, we think, well, my small faith will do for that one. But when you hit a really big one, you think, well, I need an awful lot more faith. If I'm going to see this happen, I need to have an awful lot more faith than I've shown so far. And maybe, just maybe, this is a more complicated case than any that the disciples had dealt with so far. When they saw the boy writhing and jerking on the ground, and they heard the past history of how this has just happened again and again, and all of the things we've tried, and all of the people who've prayed, and all the miracle workers who had to go, they haven't been able to affect him at all. They think, whoa, 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 we need a lot more faith than we've got here. So it's important to remember what Jesus says, isn't it? You don't need a lot of faith. If you have as much faith as a mustard seed, the smallest seed that's known in Palestine, just the tiniest little bit of faith, untrammeled by unbelief, then you can move mountains. The Hebrews had a curious kind of belief, completely unfounded in geography, that the mountains have roots, like trees, that go down into the earth. So to move a mountain was a big deal. It wasn't just shoveling out the earth and moving it somewhere else. It was a case of uprooting it and putting it. So it was something that was virtually impossible as far as they could see. And Jesus is saying the impossible becomes possible if you just have the tiniest little bit of faith. But sometimes we think, for God to give me 50p to pay my parking ticket, that's no big deal. For God to give me £5 million so I can found a hospital, whoa, I have to be a person of much greater faith to get that. Not so. It's the same kind of faith. And the importance is not how much of it you've got. The important question is, where is that faith placed? Because if you have a tiny faith in an infinite God, your tiny faith can do the most amazing things. So those are just some of the lessons I think that we get out of that first one. Let's look at the second one for a few minutes before we finish. What about this situation? Oops, I didn't want to press that one. Oh, go away. Oh, dear, sorry. All right, normal service will resume shortly. Sorry about the people who are listening to this on the tape, because it'll make no sense whatsoever if we're taping it, which you're probably not. But anyway, second story is about when God answers, and you don't expect. This is a weird story too, isn't it? Because Peter is approached by these people who are looking for the temple tax. And these are not government officials, by the way. This is nothing to do with the Romans. This is something that goes right back to the days of Moses. Because in those days, the Israelites, every Israelite male, had to contribute a certain amount towards the cost of upkeep of the tabernacle. And that was revived in the days of Nehemiah, when people came back from exile and they started rebuilding the city and the walls and the rest of it. Nehemiah imposed a tax of 1/3 of a shekel so that, again, the religious life of the community could go forward. And it seems that this had gone up a little bit in the course of history, because 2 drachmas is half a shekel. So there'd been a little bit of inflation going on here, but it does go back that far. So the people who were collecting this tax, which was something like 2 days' wages, so it's a substantial sum for a lot of people, were religious people. They weren't government administrators. And I suspect that some of them were just trying to work out who Jesus was and whether or not he really was a good Jew, whether he was an estimable rabbi, whether he thought the temple was worth supporting or not. And so they say to Peter, "Aye, we notice he's not paid." "Oh, you haven't paid either, have you?" "Well, do you pay or don't you?" And Peter, who always rushes into situations, as you know, says, "Yes, he does. Of course he does. No question about it. Jesus is an upright person. How dare you say such things about my leader? I've never been so insulted in my life. Of course he does." And he goes away and thinks, "Well, I hope he does." And he gets ready for quite a difficult conversation with Jesus. "Master, the tax, do you actually pay it or don't?" "I'm not saying you should, but I'm just interested. Do you?" And he's trying to work out what he's going to say to Jesus. And then Jesus upstages him straight away, because when they get together, when Peter came into the house, it says in verse 25, Jesus was the first to speak. And Peter's just humming and hawing, thinking, "How do I approach this? Jesus, tax." And what do you think, Simon? Think about a king. Kings support themselves by taking revenue from other people, don't they? Now, who do they take revenue from? Is it their unfortunate subjects? Is it the people that they've conquered? Is it their own family? Not their own family, obviously. They take it from others. And Jesus says, "Aye, well, that's right. So the children of a king don't have to pay." What he's obviously implying is that he and his disciples have a relationship to the king which is superior to anybody else's. And so if they're children of the king, the temple tax doesn't really apply to them. But he says, we'll do what we're supposed to do anyway in their eyes, because we don't want to offend people unnecessarily. Now, Jesus did offend people in many situations, as you know, and you just have to look back through Matthew to find the Pharisees getting very, very annoyed with him on one occasion, and the disciples saying to him, "Don't you know what the Pharisees are thinking? You've made them incandescent." And Jesus just doesn't seem to care. But here he's saying, "Well, let's not offend people unnecessarily. Let's put this money together." And so Jesus produces the money by this strange route. Peter pays the tax, and he's learned a few things. What has he learned? Well, let's just take one or two things out of this part of the story. One thing, small point, but it's an interesting one. God is at work ahead of time. Our time, okay, to meet our needs. God is at work ahead of time, it should say, to meet our needs. You see, that fish was already swimming around with a coin in its mouth when this happened. God was already providing the answer before Peter even had the question. And that's the way it often is, isn't it? When we see God answering in response to our faith, you look back at the way things have happened and you realize the truth of that Old Testament word: "Before they call, I will answer." God supplies the answer ahead of time. God has it all worked out. God knows exactly what he's doing. And this was the case here. And as Peter took the fish and took the coin out of his mouth, he must have been thinking, "Well, I never. How did God get this ahead of time? How did he work all of this out?" But that's the way that God tends to do miracles. Second principle, I think, is that the miracles of faith come through natural means. In other words, it was a real fish. It was a genuine coin. It was paid into the collection. And Peter had to go down to the seaside and catch it and open up the fish to get the coin. It wasn't that Jesus just magicked it up out of the air. "Okay, Peter, watch this. I'm going to do a trick here. Ah, 2 drachma coin. There you go. Pay that." Jesus didn't do it that way. He did it through perfectly natural means. And sometimes that's the way it works, isn't it? That God doesn't do miracles in a dramatic, exceptional kind of a way, as we sometimes wish he would. He does it through natural things. You're short of money. You don't know how to meet the need. And you pray, "Lord, meet my needs, please." What does God do? Probably he sends somebody along, somebody you already know but you wouldn't have thought about, who just gives you some money and says, "This is what God wants me to give you." Very natural, very simple, but a miracle nonetheless. Sometimes miracles happen in bizarre ways. I remember going out with Operation Mobilization to evangelize France in the summer of 1971. We didn't do it. It took us 1972 as well. But anyhow, we were going around France in these beaten-up trucks with no food whatsoever. They sent us out from Belgium with a bunch of books, which we could sell. And if we sold them, then we could spend some of the money, some of it, to eat. But they didn't want us to spend any, really, and they just said, trust the Lord. The Lord will provide. There are far too many of you for us to send you out with food. And looking at the food at the training conference, it was quite a mercy that we didn't have to live on that for the rest of the month. But they said, God will supply your needs. And we came back at the end of that. I will never forget the ways in which God had met needs. The most bizarre story, the one that sticks in my mind, was about this guy who was the leader of a team that had run completely out of food. And he's walking down the road in a little French village, just praying out loud, Lord, please help me. We need bread. Lord, you're the Lord of the loaves and fishes. Supply bread. Please give my team something to eat tonight. You know what happened? As he walked past one house, a loaf came sailing out of the window and hit him on the head. Unbelievable. He picked it up, he looked around, and nobody was coming out after it. Nobody was doing anything. He didn't think the people in the house could possibly have heard him, although he was preaching aloud, and he was praying in English anyway. So he said, thank you very much, Lord, and went back, and that was a supper. There's another team who went up a hill to pray about the fact that they had no food whatsoever, and when they got to the top of the hill, they found a hollow in which the farmers had dumped the remains of the peach harvest. They'd had a glut of peaches. Okay, it was only peaches for supper that night, but it was a lot better than anything else. And all over the place, we saw these miracles of God's provision, but they were always miracles through natural means. Third thing, small issues can cause big misunderstandings. Jesus understands that, doesn't he? And one principle that comes out of this story is, Jesus doesn't want to cause offence when no offence needs to be given. And so this is not a situation where he needs to stand up to the Pharisees in a principled way. What does it matter whether he pays 2 drachmas into the temple coffers or not? He knows very well the temple's going to be destroyed in 70 AD, and it's not going to be a question any longer. So for the moment, the bigger question is, let's not offend people unless we've absolutely got to. And so Jesus takes the course he does, because it's important that although we don't do anything to be inoffensive people, we don't cause offence where no offence needs to be created. Fourth, some battles are not worth fighting. Sometimes you can know what the principle is and yet allow your freedom to be a little bit dented, if you like, just because it's not that important. It's like that, isn't it, when Paul speaks about meat offered to idols in the book of Romans. And some people feel free to eat meat that's already been in the temple because they're not superstitious. They don't believe anything horrible and nasty is going to happen to them. They don't believe their occult influence is hanging over this prime steak. It's just good food to eat. Other Christians have real problems with it, though. How can you be a Christian and eat that food that's been tainted by being in the heathen temple? And so Paul wants the strong to respect the feelings of the weak and to restrict their freedom. They know what the principles are, but they'll restrict themselves because some battles are not worth fighting. If you're going to win the argument and lose your brother, what's the point? And another lesson, finally, I think, that comes from this is that children of a king have privileges. If you're a child of the king, if you belong to the king, then there are some things that are true of you that are true of nobody else in the world. He loves you, he cares for you, and he wants to answer your faith. There's a lot more we could say about that, but we're out of time. We're going to move on with the service now, and we'll be taking communion in a minute or two. When you take that bread and the wine, it's very normal stuff, isn't it? It's a normal loaf, normal wine, but to us it speaks of something absolutely wonderful. It points us back to a moment when the whole of life changed, when we moved from darkness to light through the cross of Calvary. That's the way God does his miracles. And that, I think, is what fish and faith is trying to tell us.